This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your host, Drew Tignanelli.
And this is Drew Tignanelli here, Money, Riches, and Wealth, here with Tom Bonbon Vasuto. Bonbon, how are you?
I'm doing well, Drew. Beautiful day.
It is a beautiful day here in Maryland, and nothing's better than when spring comes and summer is right around the corner. That, to me, the end of winter, I'm all for it.
Yep, yep.
Anyway, we have a guest tonight, and one of the reasons I wanted to do this interview is because I get the question a lot. What about gold? You see all these commercials, you hear all these different things, and you know, one of my problems with a lot of the commercials and things I see and read and hear is that they're all designed to promote fear,
right,
and to promote the response of people to do something. And I wanted to have somebody on that was more thoughtful toward the issue and doing it from a much more thoughtful, logical. And, you know, when I read, I saw Jim Rickard's book, I thought, you know, hey, there's somebody that could do this for us. And so why don't you tell us about our guest, and then we'll go right into the interview.
Yeah, well, Jim's a repeat visitor with us here. We've had him on before, and he's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Death of Money, and the national bestseller, Currency Wars, which we spoke to him about. And he's working with the Department of Defense, which is kind of interesting. He actually was the facilitator of the first ever financial war games conducted by the Pentagon. Kind of reminds me of Matthew Broderick in the old war games. But he did something with them relative to financial war games and things that can happen in the financial systems and how other countries can take each other down.
Well, there's no doubt that the cyber financial warfare has been going on for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
And most recently, most logical one that you see is Russia and Iran. Mm. You know, that's strictly a financial war that's going on. And they would love to send the bullets back our way someday,
yeah,
maybe. You know,
right,
so
right.
That was a great interview. But tonight we're going to talk about gold. And Jim, I want to start with the quick question of your title of your book is The New Case for Gold. And, you know, when I read the book, I didn't see anything necessarily that I would call new, but why do you call it The New Case for Gold?
Well, thank you, Tom and Drew. It's great to be with you. Yeah, there's actually a little backstory to the title, and there is a lot new in it, which I'm happy to explain. This kind of goes all the way back to 1971, of course. That's when Nixon suspended the redemption of dollars for gold by U.S. trading partners. Of course, Americans were not allowed to have gold long before that, but we still allowed gold redemptions by our trading partners, but that was ended in 1971. Then in 1980, of course, Ronald Reagan was running for president. It wasn't that long later, that much later from 1971. It was only 9 years later, and there was still a lot of sentiment to go back to a gold standard, and people were pressuring Reagan on that. So what Reagan did, guess what a lot of politicians do, he appointed a high-level blue ribbon a bipartisan commission to study the issue. You know, politicians love to study things. And so the commission came back, did their work, and they recommended that the U.S. not go on a gold standard. But there was a powerful minority on the committee, and they were allowed to file a minority report. That's also common in these types of commission situations. And that minority report, and the members of the minority, by the way, included Ron Paul and Lou Lehrman and some other prominent Americans. Well, that was a public record because it was, you know, government commission. So some enterprising publisher took that publicly available document, published it as a book called The Case for Gold. So here we are in 2016. My book is called The New Case for Gold. So there's a little bit of a tribute to the old title, and certainly gold investors, gold advocates. The original case for The Case for Gold is a little bit of a cult classic. It's very well fondly remembered by a lot of gold advocates. Well, my book is The New Case for Gold, so a little bit of a tribute there. But specifically what's new about it, there are arguments for and against gold that have been going on for a long time, but there are new arguments that only apply to the 21st century, and I talked about them in the book. The first one is cyber financial warfare. So Vladimir Putin has a 6,000-member cyber brigade operating outside of Moscow night and day to hack, delete, destroy, and disrupt all the digital banking and financial records in the United States. So, you know, I occasionally run into billionaires, and they're happy to tell you about their wealth. They say, oh, I own stocks and bonds and this, that, and the other thing. And I say, no, you don't. What you own are electrons. You have digital wealth. You might get a paper statement from your bank every now and then, but you have digital wealth, and if this is hacked and erased, you have nothing, and you have no way to prove it, no way to restore it. And these things happen all the time. They're not that unusual. I mean, just the other day, the country of Bangladesh, one of the poorest countries in the world, $100 million disappeared from their account at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Now, they were not depositing with the Central Bank of Bangladesh or India or Sri Lanka or anyplace else. They had their money on deposit at the Fed, presumably the safest bank in the world, and $100 million disappeared. In 2010, the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security found a Russian attack virus inside the NASDAQ operating system. This was documented in Bloomberg Magazine, July 2014. This was not some criminal gang trying to steal your credit card number. This was Russian military and intelligence assets penetrating the NASDAQ operating system. So this stuff is going on all around us. These cyber wars are being fought. Your digital wealth can be wiped out. And if you have physical, tangible gold, that cannot be hacked, deleted, erased, or otherwise, you know, digitally made to go away. So it's one way to preserve wealth in the face of these cyber financial attacks. That's the new case for gold. That was not something we talked about in the 80s, the 90s, or even the early part of the 21st century. There was no internet. There was no hacking, you know, going on to speak of prior to 2000. Even more recently, it wasn't that much of a concern. So there are other arguments in the book, but there's an example of something that...
That is definitely a new situation, and we want to address that when we come back because, you know, one of the questions is, there are a couple of questions I'd have, and I'll just give them to you because we're going to take our traffic break, but I'll give them to you to think about. One is, let's say that all the digital things are all disappeared or they cut down the whole electrical system in the United States, et cetera, et cetera, and I do have a fair hunk of gold. I guess one of the questions I have for you is, what do I do with it? What could I possibly do with it? And the second question is going to be that a lot of the gold is going to be stored electronically. You know, like you have a physical gold fund, and I can come and get it, but in the interim, I have digits that I still have with you. So you can think about those, and then you can come back and explain why that's not an issue once we come back from this traffic break. And we'll be right back with Jim Rickards. We're talking about the new case for gold. Take it away, traffic. Do you have a financial planner? Have you ever thought of hiring one? Or just need a second opinion? The satisfaction guaranteed service of the Financial Physical is designed with you in mind. Many listeners, just like you, come to me, Drew Tignanelli, host of Money, Riches, and Wealth, and president of the Financial Consulate, looking for a firm that is fee-only and can offer comprehensive financial planning. The Financial Consulate has not grown by selling insurance, annuities, and bank products. Instead, we pride ourselves on the wealth of knowledge we can provide to you and your family. Learn more about the Financial Consulate and the services that we can provide at DrewTig.com. That's DrewTig.com. Or call to schedule a no-obligation introductory meeting at 410-823-SAVE. That's 410-823-SAVE.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
We're back. Money, Riches, and Wealth. We're here with Jim Rickards. We're talking about his latest book, The New Case for Gold. And it's a timely topic because a lot of people are asking the question, should I own gold in my portfolio and so forth. So I thought Jim would be a great person to talk to. So, Jim, the digital world has been attacked, and my bank account and the bank account of 99% of the rest of the world has been wiped out by some kind of cyber attack, but I have gold. What do I do with it?
Well, first of all, your wealth is preserved. A lot of your neighbors are broke, but you're not, so that's the first thing I would say. Secondly, gold comes in many forms. You can buy a 1 gram piece. Now, I usually recommend 1 ounce American Gold Eagles. They're about $1,250 a piece plus commission, but you can buy a 1 gram bar. They're readily available. 1 gram bar is about $50.
Now, wait a minute, though. I hear you, but let's get to the point, though. You got the world is wiped out. You got chaos. I'm also going to need a big gun and a big dog to protect my gold if I go somewhere, aren't I?
Well, it's a little bit of a cartoonish view of it.
I'm good at that. Well, give me time, and I'll do more of it.
Well, it might look more like an agrarian society, like the age of John Adams or Thomas Jefferson. So you could have critical infrastructure. John Adams didn't have electricity. Thomas Jefferson didn't have the internet. But they were civilized people. They lived in nice cities like Baltimore, Philadelphia. By the way, I lived in Baltimore for 5 years myself. I love Baltimore. It's one of my favorite cities.
Where are you at now?
Well, I'm in Connecticut, area in Connecticut. Been there a long time, but I lived in Baltimore for 5 years. I still go back. I have a lot of business associations in Baltimore. I'm back there almost once or twice a month, and love the the Four Seasons at the Inner Harbor is one of my favorite places in the entire world. Great hotel and great restaurants in the area. So I'm a big Baltimore fan, among other things. By the way, you referred to the war game that we did in 2009. That was done at the Applied Physics Laboratory.
Right in Columbia.
Columbia, Laurel area. So very familiar with the area. But anyway, coming back to the point, look, there are different scenarios, but one of them is if critical infrastructure comes under attack, okay, maybe the power grid's down. It doesn't have to be permanent. Look, I lived through Hurricane Sandy in my town, Darien, Connecticut. We had no electricity for 8 days. Now, when you have no electricity, the gas pumps don't work, the ATMs don't work, the scanners at the supermarkets don't work, but it wasn't the end of the world. We went about our business. It's good to have some cash, by the way, but gold can serve the same purpose. Gold comes in a 1 gram bar. That's a little inconvenient for large amounts of wealth, but 1 gram is about $50. So that's a piece you can buy. The U.S. Mint makes a 1/10 of an ounce, so that would be about $125, let's say. So there are modest sized gold coins you can have that would be readily exchangeable for groceries for your family. So it's not like you're going to be sitting there with a 400-ounce bar and a file, like shaving off a few filings. You can buy small denomination gold.
But in my opinion, one of the best cases for gold would be something like Greece, where I'm sitting in a country where I don't control our currency, and they're tempted to go back to the drachma and confiscate my euros in my bank account. Now, in my opinion, every Greek citizen should own a lot of gold and hidden away somewhere in their house. Because to me, that's really a great, because a big black market would take place if they went back to the drachma.
Well, I agree with that completely. I agree with that totally. But I think it's naive to think that that's not happening in the United States. Our debt-to-GDP ratio keeps going up. Everyone in Washington is patting themselves on the back because they took the budget deficit from about $1.3 trillion in 2010 to about $400 billion today. That's a very significant drop in the deficit, so everyone's saying mission accomplished, but they're missing one thing. The economy's not growing. In other words, the deficit has come down, but the debt-to-GDP ratio is still going up. The deficit's still about 3% of GDP, and GDP is growing at 2%. So if your debts are going up at 3% and your income's going up at 2%, guess what? You're going broke. You may be going broke more slowly, I agree with that, but we're still on the path to Greece. We have no way out of $19 trillion of debt except by inflation. You know what's going to happen to gold and inflation.
You're
going to go to the moon.
You're absolutely right, Jim. And, matter of fact, people point to Japan and say, look, they're 230% debt to GDP, and they're actually paying minus 10.1% on their 10-year bonds. So, therefore, debts don't really matter. I disagree. One day this debt phenomena is going to catch up with us, and what it's going to look like, I'm not sure. But gold wouldn't be the only answer in that type of scenario, though, either,
well,
right?
I agree with that. By the way, my advice to investors is put 10% of your investable assets in physical gold. Now, when I say investable assets, just to be clear, don't count your home equity. Put that to one side. Don't count your business. So if you're a dry cleaner, pizza parlor operator, car dealer, doctor, dentist, lawyer, take your business equity. Put that to one side. Don't gamble with your home equity and your business equity. Whatever's left over, those are your investable assets. Put 10% of that in physical gold.
But a lot of people have that in 401k plans and IRAs and things like that. And, the only way you're going to own gold in those types of accounts is digitally.
That's not true. You can have physical gold IRAs. There are a couple firms out there. There's Gold Co. Trading, Advantage Gold and Gold Co. are two that come to mind. But there are others out there. And, you have to do your due diligence.
You're absolutely right. But you are going to own them sort of digitally, though. Even though you sort of own it physically, you are owning it sort of digitally.
Well, you know what? It's funny because you told me what the question was going to be. And while you were on commercial break or doing the traffic, I tweeted out a photo of myself. It's my Twitter handle is at James G. Rickards, the middle initial G for George, at James G. Rickards. And if you go to my Twitter feed, if you happen to be online, you'll see a picture of me holding a 400-ounce gold bar. That bar, it doesn't belong to me personally. I was holding it, but that belongs to the physical gold fund. So there is physical gold behind these investments. And physical gold fund, you can have a paper copy of the contract, a paper confirmation. The gold's in Switzerland. I'm standing in a vault in Switzerland in that picture, if any of the listeners want to have a look at my Twitter feed. So there is physical goal behind it. Yeah, there's an intermediary, there's a fund and a contract, but that's not the same as digital wealth.
Let's talk about your physical gold fund, because I find that fascinating, because everybody thinks that GLD, gold, the iShares gold, is physical gold. But your fund is very different, and so I want you to explain that to listeners who are interested in owning gold. So give us that before we have to take our next break.
Sure. GLD is what's called an ETF, or exchange-traded fund. So when you buy, the ticker is GLD, you're right. When you buy GLD, you're not getting any gold. What you're getting is a share of stock that's traded on the New York Stock Exchange. That share, it represents a unit in a trust. The trustee has a vault. The vault is in London. And they take your money, and they do go out and buy some physical gold. But you're not entitled to get the gold in any state of the world. All you can do is sell your shares. Now, if the stock exchange is closed, sorry, you're out of luck. If the power grid's down, you're out of luck. With the physical gold fund, they buy physical gold. But if you want that gold, call them up. They'll ship it to you. They'll be there, you know, the next day, so you can get your physical gold. So that's the difference. With GLD, you can never get the gold. You have to hope somebody buys your shares or all kinds of bonds. By the way, there's a lag between, and this is important, there's a lag between when GLD gets your money and when they buy the gold. So you're buying a share on the secondary market. Those shares are created by intermediaries. GLD is allowed up to 28 days to actually get the gold. Well, you know when the crunch is going to come? It'll be in those 28 days when the panic breaks out. That's when they're going to suspend redemptions on the GLD, because they won't be able to get the gold, neither will anyone else. The time to get your gold
is now.
So
how does somebody buy the gold, the physical gold fund?
Well, again, I'm not. You can find them online, physical gold fund online. By the way, they're not open to U.S. investors. They're only open to foreign investors. I'm not a seller. I am on the advisory board. I know them. I think highly of them. So just want to be clear on that. But I'm not a sales representative. I do know all about it. But that's only available to non-U.S. investors.
Is there a type of thing like that in the U.S. that our listeners could actually participate in if they wanted to?
Well, there are several. Sprott up in Canada is recommended. There are gold IRA companies. I mentioned two, Advantage Gold and Gold Co., but there are many others. They're reputable dealers. Check them out. Check their, make sure they have insurance. Make sure they ship insured. Make sure that, Better Business Bureau rating or some kind of regulation. So those are all prudent steps. But you can just buy physical gold. I mean, if you're talking about $20 million, yeah, maybe you need a vault operator and an intermediary, but if you're in the $100,000 range and you want to put $10,000 into physical gold, I would just go out and buy 10 American Gold Eagles. You can buy them from the U.S. Mint. That's a little more than $10,000, but just buy 9 or 10 American Gold Eagles and put them in a safe place.
All right. Well, we're going to take our next break. When we come back, we want to talk about the concepts that you mentioned about breaking up the banks. And also going back to the gold standard. And you might have to leave at 6:44, so I want to get into these last two big points that you make in the book, and I think they're excellent points. And right now we're going to go to traffic. We'll be right back after this, Money, Riches, and Wealth.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
See now, Anita is playing the song called The Man with the Golden Arm Theme.
Okay.
So it's Golden Arm, get
yeah,
it? Gold.
Yeah. Gold, Golden
gold,
Arm.
Golden Arm.
Johnny Unitas, the Golden Arm.
Johnny Unitas, the Golden Arm, yep.
Yeah.
There
yeah,
you go.
Yeah.
See, and Jim likes Baltimore.
Yeah.
So he has to like Johnny Unitas.
That's right.
Well, I used to drive a taxi in Baltimore. I drove for actually Jimmy's cab up in Towson.
Oh, yeah?
And,
yeah.
The Johnny Unitas Golden Arm was up on... York Avenue, I believe.
Green Mountain or York Road?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, maybe it was Green Mountain Avenue. Yes, so it was a popular destination. So, I know my way around Baltimore as a former taxi driver.
There you go.
So, Jim, one of your biggest premise in the book first is going back to the gold standard. You explain all the reasons why it would be perfectly logical to go back to the gold standard and how it can work. So I want you to help me understand how that would happen.
Well, one of the reasons I wrote the book was because, obviously, I write and speak about gold a lot. I've been in a lot of debates. And there are certain arguments against gold, and you hear them over and over. And every one of them is wrong. It doesn't hold water. They're factually, historically, empirically, or analytically incorrect. And I just got tired of hearing them. I said, well, I've got to just knock these things down once and for all. Now, most of the book is a very positive argument in favor of gold and how gold works. But these six or seven arguments, these are the kinds of things that I call them the eggheads, you know, the power elite, the central bankers, the PhDs, the Harvard professors, TV anchors, others throw up at you. I said, I'm going to shoot them down once and for all. So the first thing you hear is that there's not enough gold in the world to support trade and commerce, just not enough gold. That's nonsense. There's always exactly as much gold as there is. It's not a question of quantity. It's a question of price. Now, so every gold standard is some ratio between paper money and gold. That's all it is. And you got to figure out the ratio. So given the amount of money supply in the world, so I use Europe, China, and the United States as kind of a proxy for world money supply. Given that amount of money, if you took gold at the current price of $1,250 an ounce, that would be extremely deflationary. We'd probably put the world into a depression because you'd have to shrink the money supply to maintain the parity. But if gold is $10,000 an ounce, it works just fine. That the same amount of gold supports the money supply at a higher price.
But now, let's just address that. That would be kind of an arbitrary number that the government would just put and say, if you ever want to redeem $10,000, we'll give you an ounce of gold.
Well, that's what a gold standard is.
Yeah.
It's an arbitrary number, but you have to get the number right.
I understand. I just wanted to make sure our listeners understood what you were saying, and I understood what you were saying. So I just wanted to clarify that. Okay.
This is what Franklin Delano Roosevelt did in 1933, because at the time when Roosevelt was sworn in, gold was about $20 an ounce. The country was suffering through the longest period of sustained deflation in American history. Deflation, prices are going down, right? Guess what went up 75%? Gold. Gold went from $20 an ounce to $35 an ounce. And that was not based on market forces. That was by government fiat. President Roosevelt, there's a famous story. He was sitting in his bed in his pajamas, and he called in the Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Morgenthau, and he said, Henry, what do we want the price of gold to be today? I know. Let's bid it up 7 cents an ounce because that's my lucky number. And Morgenthau went out and called New York Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and they bid up the price of gold 7 cents an ounce. Over about 8 months, they got it up from $20 to $35. Now, FDR was very clever. What he did, he confiscated all the gold in the country of $20, and then he bid it up to $35. In other words, the government raised the price by government order, but it meant that the Treasury kept the profit. The difference between they deprived the American people of the profit, kept the profit for themselves, and that became a Treasury slush fund, which is still around today.
Well, I have no problem with what you're saying, because right now I just have a piece of linen in my pocket. At least I get something if they put an arbitrary price on gold at $10,000. I'm getting something at least for the paper if I ever want to redeem it.
Well, but you're only going to get a lot less gold for your dollar. Now, if you take your paper money and buy gold today, yes, you're going to be along for the ride when the price of gold goes up. But if you stay in paper money, you're going to miss out. Your paper money is when the price of gold goes, let's say from $1,000 to $10,000 an ounce, everybody says gold went up. That's not the right way to think about it. Gold is constant. An ounce of gold is an ounce of gold. What happened is the dollar went down 90%. It now takes you $10,000 to get an ounce. It used to take you $1,000 to get an ounce. Now it takes you $10,000. What changed? The gold didn't go up. The dollar went down. So it's people privilege the dollar, and they think of everything's priced in dollars. But if you start pricing things in ounces of gold, you can see that the dollar is actually going down. It's what happened in 1933. It's what happened in the late 70s. It's what's going to happen in the near future. But the only way to participate in that is to get your physical gold today. But the government doesn't do it to enrich gold holders. They don't like gold holders. They would do it to get inflation. See, because when you have inflation, the Federal Reserve is trying to get inflation. They told us that. That's no secret. But I call it Mick Jagger economics. The Rolling Stones had a song, you can't always get what you want. Just because the Fed wants inflation doesn't mean they can get it. They're actually not getting it, at least not very much of it. But they'll get there eventually. It'll keep printing or using forward guidance or currency wars or Operation Twist or QE4 or something. They'll eventually get there. But when they do, that inflation just erodes the value of the dollar, but gold will be along for the ride. Gold will participate in that. So my advice is to get your gold now. Don't wait until the price goes up, because then you got two problems. One, you're paying a higher price. Two, you might not be able to get it.
You made a great point in the book about the fact that inflation is really designed to benefit government and the poor. Did I get that right? Isn't that what you said in the book?
Yeah, because, well, when I say the poor, I mean if you're a debtor, someone in debt.
Right.
Inflation makes the value of the debt go down. And the government doesn't really want to do the Fed is not in the business of helping the economy or the people. The Fed is in the business of helping the banks. And the government looks out for itself. So what the government needs is, because we have $19 trillion in national debt. Everyone says you can't pay it off. You don't have to pay it off, but you do have to roll it over. I mean, Alexander Hamilton figured that out 230 years ago. You don't have to pay off the national debt. You do have to roll it over. Right now, we can't roll it over. We're getting close to the point where we won't be able to because the debt's growing faster than the economy. So you have to, it's like an ice cube. You have to melt it. The way you melt the debt is with inflation. So it's, we say to the Chinese, hey, China, you know that $1 trillion we owe you? Well, here's the $1 trillion, but good luck buying a loaf of bread because it's not worth very much. That's the American way. That's how we get off of under debt. So if you're a debtor, I shouldn't really say poor or rich. It's more like if you're a debtor, you benefit from inflation. If you're a creditor, you lose in inflation. So any saver, anybody with a, you know, fixed income pension plan, an annuity, an insurance policy, money in the bank, those are the losers under inflation.
Now, one of the interesting things about government wanting to create inflation is that when they do, and like you say, they will succeed sooner or later, is that ultimately interest rates will go higher. And interest rates go higher, all of a sudden the debt starts going up much more because right now they're financing at ridiculous interest rates.
Well, that's not correct because there's something called financial repression. So this is the other trick in their bag of tricks, right? So they want to do two things. They definitely want the inflation. They've told us that. But you're exactly right. What good does it do you to get inflation up to 2 or 3%? What good does it do you if the 10-year Treasury note goes up to 5%? Because, right, your financing costs are higher, your deficits are larger, it looks like you're no further ahead. So the trick is negative real rates. Get inflation up to, say, 3 or 4, but keep a lid on Treasuries at 2. That way your financing costs do not go up. Your interest rates are negative. Your real rates are negative because if you have a 2% nominal rate and 3% inflation, your real rate is negative 1%. I remember when I got my first mortgage. My mortgage, this was 1980. My mortgage was 13%. My poor mother cried because her first mortgage was like 2.5%, but inflation was 15% at the time. So I said, Mom, my real cost of borrowing is negative 2. The bank's paying me to be a borrower because I get to pay them back in cheaper dollars. So coming back to your scenario, get the inflation higher, but put a lid on interest rates by open market operations, by quantitative easing, by the Fed buying the bonds. And by the way, if the Fed balance sheet is stretched, they'll get the banks to buy them. And, you know, all these banks that got bailed out in 2008, they're like, hey, they couldn't believe their luck. They woke up when the shooting stopped, and they're like, hey, we get to keep our funny baloney jobs. We get to pay ourselves, you know, $10 million bonuses. We still get to run our balance sheets. There was no pain associated with that bailout. But what they miss is that they're now working for the government. The government can shut them down whenever they want. In the 1950s, a typical bank balance sheet was 50% treasuries. Today, that number is less than 5%. So they're going to force the banks to buy the treasuries. The Fed will buy them themselves. They'll keep a lid on nominal rates. That's financial repression. Let the inflation go. Get negative real rates. By the way, that is the best possible economic environment for gold.
All right. Hold on 1 second, Jim, and I appreciate you're going to be able to stay with us for the full hour, but right now I got to take traffic break. We'll be right back. Money Racer. Do you have a financial planner? Have you ever thought of hiring one or just need a second opinion? The satisfaction guaranteed service of the Financial Physical is designed with you in mind. Many listeners, just like you, come to me, Drew Tignanelli, host of Money, Riches, and Wealth, and president of the Financial Consulate, looking for a firm that is fee-only and can offer comprehensive financial planning. The Financial Consulate has not grown by selling insurance, annuities, and bank products. Instead, we pride ourselves on the wealth of knowledge we can provide to you and your family. Learn more about the Financial Consulate and the services that we can provide at DrewTigg.com. That's DrewTigg.com. Or call to schedule a no-obligation introductory meeting at 410-823-SAVE. That's 410-823-SAVE.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
And we're back, Money, Riches, and Wealth. We're here with Jim Rickards, the new case for gold. And the question we get asked quite often, should I own gold? And probably one of the most logical and well thought out stories for the case for owning gold is this book and this gentleman, James Rickard. I've listened to him and read many of his things for many years. He's not a fear monger. He's not one of these people that just tries to, you know, get people to have a reaction to do what he wants you to do. He's just merely giving you his logical case for gold. And, you know, you're in a good crowd, too, Jim. You have Ray Dalio says the same thing. And I would say anybody who knows what I just said there, Ray Dalio, he's probably one of, if not the best investor in the world right now. And he makes the same case. Jim Rogers makes the same case for owning gold. He's an excellent investor. So you're an excellent company with some very well-thought investors, not people who are just trying to sell you gold.
Well, thank you. And I've had occasion to meet Ray and Jim Rogers. I bump into Jim Rogers around the world. We're often booked in the same investment conferences, so we see each other in the green room or off stage. He's a great guy and, of course, a legendary investor and value investor. You know, Jim Rogers, before he was well-known in commodities, we're talking, you know, decades ago, he taught securities analysis at Columbia University. He was a sort of younger protege of the Warren Buffett.
Graham, yep, absolutely.
Graham, School of Investing. So he knows value when he sees it, and he sees it in commodities and he sees it in gold.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of your big points in your book is to is that you said we should break up the banks. And, you know,
right.
one of my questions is the market was going to break the big banks up in 2008, but we bailed them all out.
Correct.
What's your point? You know, I mean, I agree with you. So tell us what. But the problem is if government does it, they're going to do it wrong.
Well, the thing is, the way I approach these things, I use, I think I mentioned, I use complexity theory, which is a new science, relatively new science, not used by the Fed. I think the Fed models and the typical central bank models are obsolete. I'm using new 21st century models, including complexity theory. One of the things that complexity theory teaches is that the worst thing that can happen, so think of it from a risk management point of view, the worst thing that can happen is not a linear function of scale, it's an exponential function of scale. Now, let me explain what I mean by that. So let's say you take J.P. Morgan, take their balance sheet, and you triple it in size. How much did the risk go up? Well, if you ask Jamie Dimon, the CEO there, he'll say, well, it didn't go up very much at all. We tripled the balance sheet, but it's long, short, long, short, long, short. It all nets out. The net is fairly low. The risk went up hardly at all. If you ask my mother, who's 85 years old, brilliant lady, but not a trained economist, Mom would probably use intuition and say, well, if you triple the balance sheet, you probably triple the risk. Jamie Dimon's wrong. My mother's wrong. When you triple the balance sheet, the risk goes up exponentially, meaning it doesn't go up three times. It goes up 5, 10, 50 times, depending on the specifics. And so go back to 2008. What did we hear about? Too big to fail, too big to fail, too big to fail. Well, since 2008, the five largest banks in the United States are bigger. They control a larger percentage of the banking assets. Their derivatives books are much bigger. So everything that was too big to fail in 2008 is bigger and more dangerous today. And taking my first point that the risk goes up not in a linear way but an exponential way, there is immensely, exponentially more risk in the system now than there was then. And yet the Fed is out of ammo because they printed $4 trillion to bail it out the last time. And that money's still on their balance sheet. What are they going to do? Print another $4 trillion, go to $8 trillion, $12 trillion? Where's the limit of confidence? So all these things, we're getting ready for the next crack up. There was one in 1998. I was involved in that. That was long-term capital management. I was the general counsel. I negotiated that bailout. The world was hours away from every stock and bond market in the world shutting down. And I was on the phone with the Treasury and the CEOs of Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan. I had a front row seat on that. 2008, we know what happened. We were hours or days away from a sequential collapse of every bank in the world when the Fed intervened. But look at the sequence. In 1998, Wall Street bailed out a hedge fund. In 2008, the central banks bailed out Wall Street. In 2018, if we keep up this 10-year tempo, it's the central banks that are going to need to be bailed out.
Well,
who's bigger than the central bank? There's only one clean balance sheet left, which is the IMF. That means world money and special drawing rights, and China has a voice. So that's where we're heading.
But, you know, the problem
to prevent is to break up the banks.
Well, and I agree because, you know, they have a premise, Jim, that if I've got these derivatives and this goes wrong, then somebody's going to bail that out. And so, therefore, I don't have any risk. But the problem is that if you have one of these too big to fail companies fail, and then, therefore, there's a domino effect right through the derivative things because they're all built on the fact that they're going to get bailed out by the government.
That's exactly right. The reason the government bailed out AIG in 2008 was not because they cared about AIG financial products, but because AIG owed billions to Goldman Sachs. So bailing out AIG so they could pay their bills was a way indirectly to bail out Goldman Sachs. The individual insurance company, AIG was a holding company. It had insurance companies, and it had this derivatives book called AIG Financial Products. The insurance companies were solvent. They're not regulated by the feds. They're all state regulated, and they all have very strict reserve requirements. Those insurance companies could have been peeled off. They were solvent, so the life insurance and property and casualty insurance claims would have been paid. That was fine. You could have let AIG Financial Products as a separate entity go down the drain. Who cares? You know, a couple hundred jobs in London or Greenwich, Connecticut. I mean, too bad for them, but that's no reason to turn the world upside down. But they bailed out AIG as a backdoor bailout of Goldman Sachs because of the crony connections of all the Goldman Sachs guys running around the White House and the Treasury Department. So we have a corrupt crony economy. It needs to be broken up. I doubt it will be, by the way. I'm not, I have a lot of solutions. I'm not optimistic that any of them will be enacted. So that's why I see the collapse coming.
We only have about a minute left. What do you think the chances are of governments actually accepting the idea of going back to a gold standard?
Zero if it means do they do it voluntarily. There's no central bank or finance ministry in the world that wants a gold standard. But they may have to go to it, not because they want it, but because they're forced to do it to restore confidence. If enough confidence is lost, they'll go to gold, not because they want to, but because they have to.
Do you believe, like I do, that one of the biggest deflationary factors that's going on right now is that they are running these ridiculous low interest rates and punishing the economic force of our country, which is savers?
That's exactly right. See, the theory of low interest rates or negative interest rates is that it'll force people to save because they'll say, hey, you're getting no money, you're getting no interest on your money in the bank, so go spend it. But it actually has the opposite effect. The lower the interest rate, people say, well, gee, I better save more to make up for the lost income, number one.
That's exactly what our clients tell us.
Right. And what message is the country, what message are the banks sending? If interest rates are negative, they're sending a deflationary message. So people say, well, I don't want to spend because prices are going down. I'll wait till the prices get lower. So the government wants to encourage lending and spending, but what they're actually encouraging is savings and deferred spending, and that kills aggregate demand. So they're getting, people are smart. They can read the signals. Central banks are getting the opposite of what they want, but that's typical of central banks because they don't understand human nature.
Well, we're out of time, and I always enjoy being with you and listening to your thought processes on the concept. The new case for gold, Jim Rickards. Jim, we really appreciate you being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Anyway, this is Drew Tignanelli saying God bless.